Other selections that we heard are from the MCA reissue, Connie Boswell, Sand in My Shoes. The first six tracks that we heard featured Connie Boswell when she recorded with her two sisters as the Boswell Sisters. We heard Top Hat, White Tie, and Tails, Cheek to Cheek, I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter, The Music Goes Round and Round, Let Yourself Go, I'm Putting All My Eggs in One Basket, and between 18th and 19th on Chestnut Street. And that was this week's edition of Taking Sides, a regular Wednesday feature in which I play one side of an album uninterrupted. The time now is 2 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We frequently use the expression living in the moment to describe a state of spontaneity unencumbered by memory of the past or concern about the future. But imagine what it would be like to literally live in the moment and have no memory of what happened 10 minutes before and with no grasp of the future. My guest is neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, who is currently working with a couple of patients who have such an ongoing amnesia. He's also working with people who possess extraordinary memory. Most of Dr. Sacks' neurological research poses metaphysical questions about what it means to be human and what qualities give meaning to life. Since the late 1960s, Sacks has also worked with victims of the encephalitis or sleeping sickness pandemic of the early 20th century. The survivors were left in a permanent sleep-like state. They were like living statues, incapable of any physical movement. In 1969, Sacks administered the drug L-DOPA to several of these institutionalized survivors. The drug brought them out of their decades-long trances, and the remarkable stories of the resulting transformations are told in Sacks' highly regarded 1973 book, Awakenings, and Awakenings was recently brought out in a new edition. Plato said that to become a true doctor, a man must have experienced all his illnesses that he hopes to cure, Unfortunately, Sacks once recently was afflicted with a temporary neurological disorder. While hiking up a mountain, he fell and broke his leg, and for weeks after the fall, he had no experience of his leg. He couldn't feel it, he couldn't move it, he couldn't even experience his leg as part of his body. This part of his life as a patient is the subject of his new book, A Leg to Stand On. A Leg to Stand On has just been published by Summit Books. Dr. Sacks is a professor of neurology at Albert Einstein Medical College in New York, and I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. What would you say are some of the themes that hold together the different cases that you study as a neurologist?
I'm always interested in the nature of the experience, of the patient's experience. I suppose that's why I'm a human doctor and not a vet. I'm very much interested in the effects of all sorts of neurological conditions on perception, on the imagination, on the memory, on the power to will, the power to move, and the power to hold together as a person.
Let's talk about some of your earlier work before we get to the recent work that you're working on and before we get to your memoir as well. You started studying survivors of the sleeping sickness pandemic of the early 20th century. How did you first find out about them? Everyone had forgotten about them after they fell from the headlines.
Yes, it is very much a forgotten disaster, although it was one of great magnitude, which affected at least 1 million people, possibly more than this, and which continued over a decade between about 1916 and 1927. And there was an enormous, it hit the headlines, it was on the radio, it filled the medical journals. There was an enormous amount of interest in this. By 1930, 1935, perhaps a third of the patients died in the acute stages. Others appear to recover, but then later develop peculiar post-encephalitic syndromes. Many of these patients were put away in hospitals, asylums, back wards. If one looks at the literature, for example, there are 9,000 books and medical articles written on this up to 1935. Subsequent to that, there have only been two or three a year. when I was a medical student and when I was a resident in neurology in the 50s and the early 60s, it was scarcely ever mentioned. And so it was really a very great surprise to me in 1966 when I came to an out-of-the-way little hospital in New York and found 80 such patients.
Could you describe what kind of state they lived in and what they'd look like through the day as you'd walk by?
I suppose the first impression was that I'd entered a museum or a waxwork gallery. There were motionless figures who were transfixed in strange postures, sometimes rather dramatic postures, sometimes not, with an absolute absence of motion, without any hint of motion. So everything looked frozen. And then, very suddenly sometimes, one of these patients would be released from the state and would speak and move. And then you could see what a vivid, alive, real person was there, imprisoned in a sort of way by some strange physiological change. Actually, this hospital, which I called Mount Carmel, had been opened in 1919 precisely for such patients. And this is something which happened all over the world, that hospitals were opened or hospitals were turned over. For example, in London, the Highlands Hospital, which was an immense fever hospital covering 70 acres, was turned over and came to house 20,000 patients with encephalitis lethargica.
A lot of the way we look is really a function of the lives that we've led, you know, the posture that we have or how wrinkled our faces are, the expressions that our face naturally sets into. Now, these are people who have had virtually no experiences for several decades. Did they look differently than average people do? Did their faces for their age look differently?
Well, they did look more youthful than their age. Partly in the sort of condition the face may itself be rather frozen and not reflect feelings, but partly feelings and experience itself might be arrested as well as the physical arrest. And so, as it were, some of the ravages and or beauties which time inscribes, experience describes on the face were sometimes not there. I remember one of the nurses saying of one particular patient, the patient I call Rose, she says, that woman hasn't changed in the 30 years I've been here.
Did they have any way of communicating at all?
Well, for the most part, they didn't. A lot of the patients had some Parkinsonism, some of the symptoms similar to Parkinson's disease. But unfortunately, the medications which are of use in ordinary Parkinson's disease didn't really make any difference to them. The usually simple communications about food and toileting could be made, or the staff who had been there almost as long as the patients, you know, came to know them, that you can have a very, very intimate, remarkable sort of relation between the caretakers and the cared for in a chronic hospital. It's but no complex communications could be made except in these rare moments or minutes of release or awakening, which sometimes happened spontaneously. Sometimes there'd be something to provoke it. A patient would sneeze, and perhaps in sneezing, he might suddenly jerk himself out of this trance. He might also jerk other people out of the trance. He would startle himself into wakefulness, or perhaps a fire engine would come past. Sometimes some of these patients would respond to an emergency. if another patient had a fall or fell on the floor, someone who had been apparently unable to move a finger might leap out of his wheelchair, assist the other patient, and then fall back like a statue into his own chair.
Was there any way of knowing if they felt conscious of the state that they were in, if they had any idea that a world was happening around them and that they were immobilized and unable to take part?
I would say apart from what they themselves said in these brief releases, it remained rather uncertain until the power of communication was given to them fully. But I never doubted that these were intelligent, alive people, sort of suspended in some sort of way. But what their level of awareness of self and surroundings was, it's difficult to say. Though at some level, things must at least have been recorded, because, as I say, if there was an event, an exigency, an accident, they would respond.
You, after several, I guess, years of research, decided to administer the drug L-DOPA and see what reaction it would have on them.
I saw these patients in 1966 originally. At that time, there was nothing which had any chance or any promise of helping them, and they themselves had probably entered a sort of hopeless state, perhaps a stoical one, perhaps a despairing one. I think it varied in different patients. Early in 1967, February of 67, there came the news of a remarkable new medication, the so-called L-DOPA, which perhaps one shouldn't call it a medication. It was almost a nutrient, because it would serve to replace a missing transmitter in the brain, the nerve transmitter dopamine, which was severely depleted in Parkinson's disease. And patients with very severe motionless Parkinson's disease could be transformed by this. I then found myself wondering whether these post-encephalitic patients, who were Parkinsonian but were much else, they were catatonic, they were entranced, they were I knew not what, and they had also been put away and out of the world for decades. So I was very excited, and I will say that the patients some of the patients who, in fact, became aware of things, this ran through the hospital. There was a sort of seismic tremor early in 67 that there might be hope for such patients, where there'd been no hope before. And these patients constituted a large group in the hospital. The hospital had been built for them. I was in two minds, or more than two minds, possibly in 20 minds, about giving it. The patients were in two minds. As I say, it wasn't entirely a straightforward decision, because one knew even that some of the patients with ordinary Parkinson's disease had some odd side effects, so-called. Here, the physiology was much more complexly disturbed. And also there was, as it were, a sort of existential problem of what would one do then if one came out of things. And these considerations and other things, because at first one couldn't get hold of the stuff, it was enormously expensive, it wasn't freely available, one had to get a special license. And so 2 years passed before I actually gave it in March of 69.
And you wrote that you were really surprised at the suddenness, at the immediateness of the reaction. What were the first signs that they were leaving that trance-like state that they had been stuck in?
Well, the suddenness was incredible, and nothing which I'd read about gave me any hint of this. Patients with ordinary Parkinson's disease don't respond in the sudden way. They tend to warm up gradually. Maybe one had seen, as it were, a built-in tendency to suddenness with these patients in the way in which they might suddenly snap out of things if there was a fire engine or a sneeze or something like this. Some of the patients came out more slowly, some instantly changed. With the patients who came out more slowly, one would see over a period of days a sort of melting of the rigidity of the frozen picture. There would be the beginnings of spontaneous movement, the beginnings of speech, the beginnings of attention and looking around, the beginnings of animation. It was like seeing frozen figures thawing. And with this, a great delight, as an awakening or sort of resurrection, might be expected to have.
Did they have comprehension of what had happened and what was happening?
Absolutely. One had not quite known what they had before, but it became perfectly clear then. Although the comprehension was of an odd sort, with one patient, the patient I call Rose in Awakenings, she became very excited and rather salacious and was full of boundary jokes and songs. She was talking about Gershwin all the while, and she loved singing. And some of her gestures and some of her speech was of an obsolete sort, and sort of reminded me of a flapper, reminded me of the 1920s. And I found myself thinking, where is this woman? You know, is she oriented? What's going on? I asked her a few questions. Asked her she's a very quick woman. She says, look, she says, I know the date of Pearl Harbor. I know the date of Kennedy's assassination. She says, I know it all. It's all recorded. She says, but none of it seems real. She says, nothing has seemed real since that night in 26 when I got the encephalitis and came to a stop. And she says, I know I'm 64 and that this is 1969 and that I'm an elderly woman in a bizarre situation in a chronic hospital. But I feel I'm 21. I feel it's 1926. And now for her, there was a tremendous anachronism between what she formally knew and what she actually felt.
You know, it's sometimes interesting to fantasize about what it would be like if you were in a position like that, you know, if you were frozen for decades and then come alive and you think, God, I'd appreciate life then so much more than I appreciate it now because everything would be so special. You know, every smell and taste and everything, movement itself would be such a delight, everything we take for granted. But then would that feeling last very long? and what happened to these people was, I guess, because of the drug, that everything kind of backfired after not so long.
Well, there was a quality of a fable about this in the spring and the summer of 69. I mean, I thought of the Sleeping Beauty and Rip Van Winkle and all the others. In a sort of way, it seems to me that I work, or perhaps in neurology, certain sorts of neurology, one can work, as it were, at the intersection of fact and fable. You see infinitely moving, dramatic, romantic situations, but always clearly based on the state of the nervous system and what's happening. But yes, as you say, the first there seemed to be the dawn of a new day. the birth of a new life. There was great joy and a sort of lyrical delight in the world which had been given back. I remember one patient stroking leaves and looking at the night lights of New York on the horizon, and everything was a source of delight and gratitude. This was the sort of quality at first. But then there were problems. The problems one first saw were really problems of excess. The patients had had not enough life, not enough movement, not enough emotion, not enough dopamine before. And now they started to have too much, and things started to run away, and joyous feeling became mania, and normal movement became violent mobility, frenzy, tics, sudden movements, sudden excesses, sudden passions. It wasn't clear to me then how much this turning over to the opposite pole from trance to a sort of frenzy. I didn't know how much this was purely physiological and based on the drug and the nervous system, and how much it might have to do with their extraordinary predicament, which was basically that they were coming to and they were being awakened and animated, but often in a vacuum, often to a world which no longer made sense for them, which had no place for them, in which they no longer had relatives, friends, or anything. This certainly seemed to be somewhat the situation with Rose. And she said, "I hate your television world." She says, "Nothing has any sense to me. I don't care for it." With her in particular, after about 10 days of extraordinary but somehow anachronistic excitement, she relapsed or returned again. I don't know what word to use, or regressed to this strange, to the state she had been in before. And thereafter, nothing we could do made any difference. I couldn't help feeling there in some sort of way that that her feelings or her will or her personality had somehow had the last word and had, but undoubtedly physiologically, there is a tendency with these patients to go from one extreme to another.
You wrote that many of them found some kind of middle state eventually. A few of them are still alive. What kinds of lives are they living now? Are they still institutionalized?
Well, the 1969 then was a period of violent drama. They emerged from their trance. They awakened. Things were fine for a while. Then they got into various states of frenzy, and sometimes frenzy alternating with trance, and sometimes many times a day. But then, one way and another, for most of the patients, not all of them, some sort of happy medium and a sort of life became possible. Some of the patients did have friends and relatives outside, and were able to leave the institution they had never thought to leave, and which nobody else thought they. With this institution, people usually only leave it in a box. We hadn't had discharges before. Other patients who didn't have relatives, who didn't have support systems, to use the jargon, or who were still variously disabled, stayed in Mount Carmel, but had a reasonably full life. And the home, the hospital, is full of resources of one sort and another, from gardens to workshops to music to other things. And quite a full social life and other life was possible. And in general, I'd say that whatever makes life possible for all of us, what Freud called work and love, was the most important thing, the most important non-chemical thing with them in allowing some sort of stability.
My guest is neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, who has written about this work that we're discussing now in his book Awakenings, which was recently published in a new edition. You know, these are such a compelling story, and obviously it's been a compelling kind of story for centuries. I'm thinking of like the fairy tales about people who are suspended in time, and then, you know, in modern times, if we look at TV, like between the Twilight Zone and the Outer Limits, that's also a very popular theme for science fiction and fantasy. You must have been changed by this experience of actually, you know, witnessing this experience that usually only exists in science fiction or fable.
I don't read as much fiction or perhaps science fiction as I should. Partly, I think, because I'm presented with it in real life. I certainly had no idea, and perhaps no one had any idea that it might be possible for existence to be suspended in this sort of way. And also, there can be some very frightful depths and abysses which lie in wait for these patients. I think there's certain, I feel like saying certain forms of hell, certain hells which are only known in the depths of neurological disorder. No doubt there are also all sorts of hells in the depths of psychological disorder, but they may be of a somewhat different sort. One tends to think of hell as a permanent place. I mean, I think it was finally the resilience of the human soul that one could spend not a season, but 4 decades in a sort of hell, or if not hell, at least a sort of limbo, and come out not destroyed.
Well, I want to quote something that one of the people who administered the L-DOPA-2 had communicated through like a spelling board before the drug was administered, and he said, "I have no exit. I'm trapped in myself. This stupid body is a prison with windows but no doors." I just found that a kind of immensely moving quote to read.
Well,
a very literary one as
yes,
well. I must say.
Well, I think that I think illness and deep illness may force one to think, even if one hasn't been a thinking person before, and perhaps force one to think in the terms which all people think of, which are terms of metaphor, of the imagination, of myth. I think, now, if you just catechize patients, if you give them the usual sort of neurological catechism, if you interrogate them in a narrow way, you get narrow answers. Sometimes one has to do this sort of medicine, but I think this sort of quick interrogatory medicine is too common. At least in a chronic hospital, you have in some sense, for better or worse, all the time in the world. You have a sort of freedom, and a sort of depth of relationship can develop, and patients can express themselves, can grope for expression. Perhaps this is something, I mean, the doctor and the patient, the investigator and the subject, I mean, between them, perhaps they find some sort of discourse, some ways of expressing things. But many of the patients seem to me to be poetic, and as it were, to have become poetic, and to Auden has a phrase about being wounded into art, and I sometimes felt this was the case with many of the patients.
I'm speaking with neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, and the case studies that we're discussing are written about in his book Awakenings, which is recently republished. He also has a new book about some of his own experiences with a neurological problem in his leg after it was broken, and that's called A Leg to Stand On. Let's talk about some of the work that you're doing now with people who have a memory cutoff. You have a couple of patients who were struck at some year with a loss of memory of everything past that point, and they can remember up to 1979 or up to 1945, and that's it. And then they don't remember what happened a minute ago.
Yes, I am. This is a well-known and well-described condition, although it may not be that common. It's sometimes called Korsakoff syndrome, after the Russian who described it about a century ago. As Korsakoff described it, this is a condition which, if it occurs, is usually from alcoholic damage to certain parts of the brain. I'm not saying that all heavy drinkers get it. Even among very heavy drinkers, it's sort of rare. Again, there's some other things, tumours and so forth, which can produce this. What Korsakoff brought out was that there was at first a severe disturbance of recent memory and perhaps of registration, so that within a few seconds there was no trace, or very little trace, of what had just occurred, which might lend a sort of a radical incoherence, discontinuity to life, but that intelligence, personality, humour, resourcefulness, wit might be perfectly preserved and indeed, in a sense, enhanced, because the people would continually have to make sense of something which perhaps didn't make sense. I've known several such patients, and the situation of working in homes and chronic hospitals, as I indicated with the post-encephalitics, it allows a sort of length and depth of relationship, which so I have some, with some of these patients, I've known them for a decade. With one such man, whom I call Jimmy, in a piece that I wrote, my first meeting with Jimmy, he was very charming, very pleasant. I was wearing a white coat. He called me Doc. At one point, I had to leave the room for about 30 seconds, and when I came back, there was no recognition whatever, but as it were, he said hi, Doc, and it all started again.
Well, you told him the joke of because you were trying to explain to him that he had no memory.
Yes,
and you told him the memory lapse joke. Do you want to tell a joke and tell us how he responded?
Well,
if you got
well, if I can remember it, Jimmy kept saying, "Why am I here? Why am I seeing you?" He didn't even know it was a hospital. He thought it might, at one point, that it might be a technical institute, and then he saw people in wheelchairs. He thought maybe he was employed in this place, but then he realized he was in a wheelchair. But as he said, he didn't feel ill. He didn't feel there was anything the matter. He didn't know why he was there, or why I, a doctor, was seeing him. And so I said that he had some problems with his memory, and I told him a story which I'm afraid I may forget, but I will try to remember it. I said a patient went to his doctor complaining of memory lapses, and his doctor asked him a few questions and then said, "These lapses of yours." And the patient said, "What lapses?" And Jimmy laughed and said, I guess that's my situation. I mean, it was very strange, and that this subject of discussion was continually forgotten, including the centre of the discussion, which was that he couldn't remember things. I asked him to tell me about himself. Although obviously I ask for specific symptoms, I always also like to encounter the patient as a person. I like to know about their early days and their interests and how life has been. And as soon as I stopped quizzing Jimmy and just asked him to tell him about himself, his whole demeanor changed, and he told me very vividly, in great detail, very movingly, and obviously reliving all the emotion, about his childhood in a small town. He'd obviously been a bright student with a penchant for science and mathematics at school. He had extraordinarily vivid memories of school. He could remember many of the school teachers, many of his school chums. I thought this was sort of strange for... At 50 would be hard put to remember, more than two or three of my school teachers or schoolmates of 35 or 40 years ago. And then Jim went on to speak of the war and how with his technical abilities, he became a radio operator. He worked on submarines. And again, these were described in great detail. He'd been on a number of submarines, but one in particular. And he recreated the life of his life as a submariner beautifully. And then he stopped. And I said, go on. And he looked at me a bit strangely. As someone, if you ask someone to tell you their life story and they told it to you up to the present and you then said, go on, they'd look at you strangely. It was as if, in Jimmy's mind, he had taken me up to the present and then I'd said absurdly, go on. And so... By this time, his story had come to about 45, 46. The war was over. As he put it, Truman was at the helm. He was wondering about future plans, whether he should stay in the Navy or go on for a higher degree. And his story ended there.
You took out a mirror. And showed him his face in the mirror.
At that point, I said, I said, Jimmy, what year is this? And he said, it's about 46, Doc. He says, Truman's at the helm and all that. I remember that phrase, Truman's at the helm. Now, I didn't know whether I was, I had never heard talk from a patient before like this. Now, my patient, Rose, had appeared to be in the past, but it was very evident from Mum, from talking with her, that she had a consecutive documentary memory from 1926 onwards. She might not have felt any personal involvement, whereas Jim didn't seem to have this documentary memory. Rose may have felt she was 21, but she knew she was 64. But Jim, apparently, it seemed to be his firm impression, and his firm intellectual impression, that he was 19 or 20, and that it was 1946. And at this point, I did something which I sort of reproached myself, but it was an impulse. I was staggered by all this. I grabbed the nearest mirror, and I put it in front of him, and I said, is that the face of a 19-year-old? He was 49 at the time. And this produced a really sort of severe panic reaction. in disorientation. He said, what are this, some sort of joke, nightmare? He got very, very upset and came apart. And I sort of put the mirror away and distracted him. I took him to the window. There were some kids playing baseball down there below, and I pointed to that, and I then stole out of the door, feeling I might have done something quite monstrous. I came back. I said before that I had left for 30 seconds. The 30 seconds I left for was after the mirror. I came back about 30 seconds later. Jim had no memory of the mirror, thank God, and no memory indeed of the fact that he had spoken to me and told me his life story.
You know the old cliche that ignorance is bliss, and you know what you don't know doesn't hurt you. Here is someone trapped in a world without memory, without recent memory, and in a perpetual state of confusion because they don't know where they are or what they're there. Do you think he was in a perpetual state of pain, though?
No. I've seen other patients with this sort of thing, but with Jim, there seemed to be a sort of unconcern. Now, he is a cheerful man. He is a nice man. He's a decent man. He was helpful. He was thoughtful. He was resourceful. He enjoyed card games. He was very good at them. If they were quick, if they were slow, he got lost. If he helped other patients, he liked going out into the garden. But he did, in a way, seem to me, his life seemed to me to consist only of these immediate moments. Now, whether he himself, he seemed to us to be lost, as it were, in immediacy, to be a man, in a sense, without a past, and by the same token, without a future. And perhaps one should say that this, what's called we're dealing here with amnesia. The forgetting of what happens immediately in a few seconds is sometimes called an anterograde amnesia. You see this in every patient with Korsakoff's. In addition to this, you may have some degree of retrograde amnesia or a retrograde loss of memories. This has been well described, although I'd never realized one could have. In effect, this was I first saw Jimmy in 75, and he thought he was 1945. There was he had lost 30 years. But he seemed a cheery chap in the present. I couldn't quite tell whether he had a sense of being lost, whether he was yearning, whether he was pining, or whether he was, so to speak, living in a state of 1945. I wasn't quite sure.
When you're with a patient like that, how much of you is like studying them as metaphor, you know, as opposed to, like, you know, figuring out a cure for them, and there isn't an apparent one.
Well, I don't know that is opposed to it. Probably both all the time. The patients are metaphors and poems, but they're also sort of acute clinical challenges. One of the things which was very striking and is striking and important with Jim is to see how he could be engaged in the present. And in particular, this was first mentioned to me at one point. He seemed so indifferent and lost. I remember this was a religious home. I said to one of the sisters, "Do you think he has a soul, or has he somehow been de-souled by his disease?" And she was a bit outraged by this, but she could see why I asked it. And she said, well, you go watch Jimmy in the chapel. And I did so. There was a service, there was a mass. And he was obviously totally, devoutly involved in this. His attention, his understanding, his participation wasn't lost for a moment. There was no sign of the Korsakoffs, no sign of a failing memory. And here, in this act of, when it seemed when he was absorbed, taking part, spiritually or whatever, that that everything felt intensely real, and he came across as quite real. And again, I saw this with music. And sometimes when he was in the garden, he loved gardening, and this gave a sort of a reality and a feeling of existence to him, which I think he didn't have at other times. I won't say that he mourned its loss, but he didn't have it, and he just looked rather lost, as opposed to actively alive and attentive in chapel or on concerts, gardens.
My guest is Dr. Oliver Sacks, if you're just joining us. And I'd like to talk about the subject of the new book that you've written. And the book is called A Leg to Stand On. And this time, the subject is you and a problem that you had after you broke a leg while hiking up a mountain. And you had quite a way to go with that broken leg. And I guess you severed a nerve and lost the feeling eventually in that leg and lost the feeling that it was even connected to you. You quote Montaigne quoting Plato in your book as saying, to become a true doctor, a man must have experienced all the illnesses he hopes to cure. Do you believe that? Do you feel any better a doctor having experienced the leg problem?
Well, obviously the quote as it stands, and Montaigne remarks this, is impossible. You can't, wouldn't want to have a doctor who'd had every possible illness and injury any more than you'd want a judge who'd committed every possible crime. and one would not wish or prescribe, excuse me, an experience of injury or illness for anyone. But if it happens, then I think it may be important for an individual, especially if one is oneself a doctor or a nurse or taking care of the sick, as it were, to experience it fully and without some of the usual blinkers, to let it really enter the soul, and I think one may come out of it feeling very differently, because in some sense you can't know what an experience is like unless you've had it. In particular, as a doctor, one deals with sickness. It may be you don't have to have had all the sicknesses, but to have had any sickness, to have had anything which can be remotely compared to what your patients have, to have been in any situation, perhaps of helplessness or dependence, will give you a feeling of what this is like, which you wouldn't have had before, which the best theoretical insight couldn't have given you before. My own accident was certainly not sought for. I was in good health. I was active. I wasn't exactly climbing, but it was a sort of steep mountain path. I had a contretemps with a bull, and a fall. Came off a cliff. Actually, what happened wasn't a broken leg. It was rather more complicated. I mean, I wish it had been a broken leg, but if it had just been a broken leg, then I probably wouldn't have had the story of a leg to stand on. In fact, the big muscle of the thigh, the quadriceps, had been torn off at its attachment. The quadriceps is attached both at the knee and at the hip, so in effect both of those joints were put out. And there was also, in the attempt to... I didn't think I would survive this. I was alone. No one knew where I was. It was in northern Norway. It was a batty thing to have done. It was a mere fluke that I was found by a couple of reindeer hunters at the end of a long day of trying to struggle down the mountain with this thing. There was quite a lot of nerve damage as well. I thought surgery would be straightforward, and perhaps it would have been straightforward again had it simply been a tendon repair, and had there not also been a lot of nerve damage. About 2 days after the operation, I started to discover some very queer things indeed. And I didn't expect any of them, and I had difficulty communicating them.
You know what I'd like to know? We talked before about how you're not only trying to help the patients who you work with and find some way to help them recover, but they're also like a fable or a metaphor for you. Now, can you do that to yourself? I mean, because for me, I, you know, when I have pain myself, any transcendent ability is difficult. It's difficult to achieve. And the thing that you can learn with some distance by watching someone else, you don't have that distance when it's yourself. I mean, were you able to?
I don't know that I had any distance. I sort of had the feeling of having been flung straight into a drama, which was not of my making, and perhaps in which I was simultaneously sort of actor, author, participant, but a sort of neurological drama. Now I will say that I have since had one bad accident, but it wasn't associated with anything strange, and I found it simply vexatious and boring, but nothing very profound happened. I was just irritated by disability and the. But with this 74 incident, which I describe, first there was a feeling of tremendous gratitude and loving the world, simply because I'd been saved. I thought I was going to perish on the mountain, especially when twilight came and the Arctic night was upon me. And then there were these shouts. These reindeer hunters had bivouacked nearby. They heard a rustle in the undergrowth. They thought there was big game. They came out and their big game. I was their game. I mean, that shout from them was a shout from life itself. I mean, there was great joy there. And then I didn't really. I thought the drama was over. I thought it would all be the day on the mountain. You know, thinking you're going to die and then being rescued. That's drama enough. But a different sort of drama was in store. There was a lot of tissue damage, and I was quite ill and delirious for a couple of days or so after surgery. And then I came to, and feeling a lot better, and assuming all was well. About 48 hours after surgery, I came to. I thought, well, the muscle's connected now. It'd be nice to contract it, and I tensed it. At least I thought I tensed it. Nothing happened. I thought that's odd. And I tried again, and I was sort of worried by this. But then I put it out of my mind. But then the next day, when the physiotherapist came, it was absolutely clear that that I couldn't work the muscle or indeed move the leg much, and that there was a sort of paralysis, which I hadn't been prepared for. Perhaps one of the things which may need to be remarked is that even a paralysis at a peripheral level, when a nerve, or a spinal nerve or a peripheral nerve is damaged, can feel very queer. In particular, normally when you make a move, you don't think how to do it or what to do. The move is spontaneous, it occurs straight away. And you don't have the business of deciding to do something, having an act of will, and then it doesn't happen. I wondered if my will had broken down. I requested the leg to move, and it didn't move. And moreover, I got no signal that my request had been received. I will say this happens when the receptors in a muscle don't answer. So there was a strange sort of silence, a strange motor silence. And then a bit later that day, there was an incident. I'd fallen asleep, and a nurse looked through the little pane of the door, and she came in on a hurry, and she said, "Watch it, Dr. Sachs, you'll have the leg off the bed." And I said, "Nonsense, it's right in front of me." And she says, "Not, it's half off the bed." And I says, "You're joking." And she said, "Look." And I looked, and to my amazement, the leg, which I assumed to be straight in front of me, somehow when I'd been asleep, I must have kicked the leg in the cast half off the bed. And I was sort of staggered by this, because the leg wasn't where I thought it was, where I'd taken it to be. And I asked the nurse to move it around, and I couldn't feel it being moved. There was a complete absence of any position sense. This, again, is something which can happen if the little receptors and joints and tendons, which normally signal position of limbs, are out of action. And then, following on this, there came an uncanny feeling that the thing wasn't real.
I just want to say here that although I really wish we had several hours to talk, we only have about 3 minutes remaining because the time has just flown. I want to say that you got your feeling back in your leg.
16 days later, yes.
Yeah. And do you feel a connection with your patients now that you didn't feel before?
Yes. I've been through it. I've been through the specifics of the leg situation, but I've also known what it's like to be in hospital, to, as it were, to have a name tag and a white gown put on you, to be at the mercies, tender or harsh, of doctors and nurses, and to be in a different category, because being a patient is a different category. It's a different social category. It's a special category. I think you don't know you can't quite know what patienthood is like unless you've been a patient. It doesn't matter what sort of patient. And I think it's important for doctorhood to have had a personal experience of patienthood.
I'm going to do something very unfair and ask you that if in 1 minute you can explain something that seems to be a theme that runs through your books, and that is that every disease is a musical problem, every cure is a musical solution.
Say with Parkinson's, you see Parkinsonians who can't walk but they can dance, they can't talk but they can sing. I think that the musical organization of action and movement and perception is absolutely central. And I found this in my own recovery where I had to, where a tune came to me at the moment of getting my own kinetic melody back. And it is absolutely the same with people with cerebral palsy, with Parkinson's. We have a full-time musical therapist at Mount Carmel. She is not a luxury, she is a necessity. And I think this business of life being musical and musically organized, and even elementary things like walking, having to have a rhythm and a melody of its own, is absolutely fundamental and forms a very powerful, immediate way of rehabilitating patients.
Well, this has really been a fascinating hour, and I can't thank you enough for coming to visit with us. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's been a very great pleasure. Thank you.
And I've been speaking with neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, who's a professor of neurology at Einstein Medical College in New York. And I want to tell you about the books that he's written. The latest is about his own leg injury and his recovery from that. And that's called A Leg to Stand On. And that's just been published. The title, again, is A Leg to Stand On. His earlier book, Awakenings, was recently published in a new edition, and that's the book about his studies with post-encephalitic sufferers. And A Leg to Stand On is published by Summit Books. And can you tell us who the publisher is of the new edition of Awakenings?
Dutton.
Okay.
Yes.
Good. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much.
And it's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. And I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. But first, let's check in with shadow traffic.
Good afternoon. A couple of problem spots for you in southbound I-95. Expect a minor delay at Callow Hill due to a tractor-trailer fire off to the side of the highway.